Hello and welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. Our mission here is to offer hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. What follows is the audio from selected videos posted on Recovering from Religion's YouTube channel. So sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Today we have the wonderful Daniela Sousa. Her pronouns are she and her. She's a PhD who helps moms grapple with what it means to make a person. She's a philosophical coach and co-creator and co-host of Think Hard podcast, which brings philosophy to the real world. So she has a PhD in philosophy and a graduate certificate in women's studies from Temple University, and also a certification in philosophical counseling from the American Philosophical Practitioners Association. When her daughter was born, she almost broke her brain trying to figure out what the hell happened. And now she helps other moms make sense of motherhood. So Danielle, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So you broke your brain? Is that...
Yeah, it's kind of a long story. Maybe I'll sprinkle some of it in during today, but it was pretty ugly for a while there.
Well, today we're going to be talking about, you're going to be talking to us about creating meaning without a God. Now that is kind of a huge topic and sometimes like super esoteric. Do you think you'll be able to kind of bring it to the real world so that we can have some actionable things we can take out from it?
I mean, I hope so. Yes, it is sort of abstract. Philosophers are sort of notorious for talking about abstract things, but I call myself a practical philosopher. So I really have always believed that philosophy is really meant to help people live better lives and to transform people's lives. And so I always sort of approach philosophical discussions with the assumption that we can all take these things into the real world.
Yeah, I really like that. I struggle sometimes reading through philosophy. It seems so out there. I can't relate so much of it into my real life or even take like away how I can, what actions I can take. So I like the term practical philosopher. It sounds like we can kind of understand things a lot better and use them in our real life. So we're kind of talking about meaning here. Where do we start? What does the value or meaning mean, really?
Yeah. Well, I suppose I want to just back up one quick, I didn't warn you about this, but I'd want to back up a little bit and just tell a little bit of my journey of how I got to be where I am. I kind of grew up myself in an evangelical background. And when I went to college, I started taking philosophy classes and I started kind of questioning my upbringing, and it just got to a point where I couldn't believe in it anymore and everything started to kind of fall apart.
That college, man, it has such a tendency to do it.
And I remember too, I wanted to take a class on Friedrich Nietzsche and I had to get my advisor to sign off on it because I was adding it. It was an upper level course and I was a freshman. And I was like, I'd really like to take this class and the teacher will let me in, but you need to sign it to approve. And he was like, Nietzsche, huh? He's going to corrupt your morals. And you're like, he was right. But I took the class. I took a class on Nietzsche. I took a class on Hindu philosophy and Buddhist philosophy. And between those two things, it was all over for my Christian upbringing. And so it was this real time of incredible loss for me, where I felt like I had this whole world of meaning built up, where it was, I knew what I was supposed to do. I was supposed to believe in God and pray and go to church and follow the Bible and do these things and don't do these things. And it was this whole complex web of meaning and what the sense of what gave my life direction and purpose. And when I lost that, I felt totally rudderless. I just I was in a big, vast, wide ocean and didn't know where to go from there.
I can totally 100% relate to that. Totally relate to it.
Yeah. And I can imagine, many people on the call probably can, right? And I think a lot of us go through that, whether it's with religion, whether it's with, loss of faith in our government or in a relationship or in our parents or in, you know, a community, whatever it might be, these things kind of fall to pieces and we are left kind of standing in the big abyss wondering what to do now. And so for me, it was just like, well, I don't know, I'm going to like read a bunch of Buddhism and other things and try and like sort out what I think and cry a lot and talk to my professors a lot and like try and figure it out. And eventually, slowly, I did. You know, I started to kind of rebuild this belief structure that really felt like mine, and that felt so satisfying. I felt like I was coming out from underwater, and I suddenly was like owning my beliefs, owning my my way of in the world, and I loved that experience so much that that's why I went to study philosophy, because I wanted.
Wow. So the whole transition part was transition out of religion part was a impetus for you to get into what you're doing now.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just like, philosophy changed my life, and it taught me how to think for myself. It taught me how to like think critically and to feel like I could own my beliefs and really take responsibility for them. And I want to give that to other people. I want to like teach other people how to go through that transition. So that's why I went and got a PhD and became a teacher of philosophy.
Love
yeah,
it.
I totally relate to that too. Not in the same sense because I was never religious, but when I started thinking about philosophical concepts and how I position myself philosophically, it really helped me build this like thought process and the way in which I seek truth, which before it was more intuitive. And now it's a lot more like logical, and to me it makes more sense, and it just makes me a lot more confident in the positions that I hold. So I think this can be applied to literally any person who is watching right now, because it's such a revolutionary thing to realize how much impact philosophy can have in your life.
Yeah, and philosophers do a really bad job of spreading that message. Like, I think that as a discipline, like, philosophers tend to kind of like shoot themselves in the foot because we try and, you know, use language that's really esoteric and exclusionary, and like it's all it's doing is making people think that philosophy is not for them. And I just think that's not true. Like, philosophy is accessible to everyone. You just have to be willing to ask the questions and be curious. So anyway, that's my background. That's like how I came to this field and to thinking about meaning and thinking about my life and its meaning. So to answer your question, Eric, about, you know, where do we begin talking about meaning? And the way that I think is an important sort of structure to start with here is that in my mind, there are three basic sources of meaning in the world, right? There's the natural environment. We can look around and see nature. And there are certain schools of thought and religions that really focus on the natural environment as a source of meaning and values, right? So a lot of indigenous religions and schools of thought, animism, spiritualism, Chinese Taoism tends to be very naturalistic. This idea that the natural world, there's like wisdom and meaning in the natural world. And if we look to that, we will know how to behave and how to think of ourselves as like fulfilling a place in the world. So the first is naturalism. The second, I'm going to call supernaturalism. And by that, I just mean super meaning above. So like above nature, outside of the realm of the natural mm-hmm. world. And that's where we look at the theistic religions, right? So that's when you refer to God or gods. And anything that is above the natural world that has the source of meaning. And this is, you know, the Judeo-Christian and Muslim faiths, right? That it's like, there's the God and God has the rules and the rules come down to us. And here are the Ten Commandments. And this is what you do and this is what you don't do. And here's the structure for meaning, right? And so that's the second one. And then the third one is that the source of meaning is human beings. And this is what we would call humanism. And there are plenty of schools of thought that adopt a kind of humanism. You know, Confucianism in Chinese philosophy, and existentialism is the one I'm most familiar with. I wrote my dissertation on philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, who was a French existentialist. And so I'll be referring mostly today to the humanistic source of values, because it's the one I'm most familiar with and know the best. But certainly for those who are more familiar with the sort of natural source of values, there's plenty of richness there too. So there's those three sources of meaning. And then I think the other thing to kind of delineate here and think about is, as a philosopher, we always start with definitions. We've got to make sure that, like, we're all talking about the same thing and that we all mean the same thing. And
right. So
I think the first question is, like, well, what, when we say, like, what is the meaning of life, or what, where do we find meaning? I think a lot of times people use the words meaning and purpose interchangeably. And I think they're slightly different. And I just want to, like, kind of draw out a distinction between them, just for some clarity's sake. In my mind, a purpose is like the function or the aim of a thing, right? And the meaning is the actions in relationship to that function or purpose. So let me give an example.
Yeah. Let's I'm kind of thinking like a wrench or a car or something like that. But what example you got?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could use a tool, right? Like if you had a wrench, if the meaning of the wrench is to like turn bolts, right? Or the purpose rather of the wrench is to turn bolts, then if I like, you know, painted the wrench pink and added like a horn to it.
Oh.
Right. The meaning, like the horn would seem sort of meaningless in relationship to the function of the wrench. Right.
So it's the purpose is the sort of the use of it, but the meaning is kind of what we apply to it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So like the other example I was thinking of is like something that's going on right now. Let's say you've got a bunch of people marching in the streets who are there, and they're shouting and they've got signs. And if their purpose is to disrupt life and make it known to the powers that be that there are things in the social world that they don't agree with and they want changed, then that marching in the streets and shouting and like holding signs seems very meaningful, right? Like, I'm going to do this because this is meaningful for this end or aim that I have.
Okay.
If the purpose that those people have is to like play a Bach concerto, then like marching in the streets is not going to like be very meaningful to that purpose, right? It's like going to seem sort of meaningless to go marching in the streets unless you're doing it like for exercise or something, in which case the purpose is exercise, right?
Yeah.
And so when you think about what the meaning of the action is or the meaning of your life is, you have to think about it in relationship to what you think the goal or the aim or the function of your life is. So that's just, you know, and I'll probably use them somewhat interchangeably, but like, I just think it's helpful so someone said in the chat, like meaning, actually let's swap those. The purpose is the goal and the meaning is the activity in achieving the goal, or like the relation or the value given to the activity that's in achievement of the goal.
Okay. So meaning is a value statement in a sense.
Yeah. Okay. Right. All right.
And then the purpose is the action, the maybe even the useful, like the physical usefulness in a sense.
Yes. And it doesn't always have to be physical, but yeah, the usefulness, right? Okay. Like when we say, like when people are like, I don't know what my purpose is, or I'm trying to find my purpose. It's like, well, what am I here for? What's my usefulness? Why am I taking up space in the world? Right.
All right. So maybe I can apply that to this, like a purpose for me would be to leave this world a better place. Mm-hmm. And then this RFRX discussion has meaning to me because it is leaving this world a better place.
Yes, right. Because it's in relation to that purpose, it's contributing to that purpose. And so therefore it's meaningful to do. So you may, you know, you may feel like washing dishes is kind of meaningless, but if you're doing it because the purpose is you are caring for your family and your household, and you're creating a home in which you are supporting the people in your life, then it can feel very meaningful.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, that's a better way to look at washing dishes, because I hate doing that.
I mean, you know, there's Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a Tibetan Buddhist philosopher, says, if you can't wash the dishes to wash the dishes, then you won't be able to enjoy your tea when you're drinking your tea afterwards either. So,
okay. So the purpose in some sense answers the why.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Got it.
Right. So I think I'll be referring to kind of both as we go through. And I think a lot of people, when they ask, like, how do we find meaning without God, or how do we find meaning in a outside of religion? A lot of times what they're asking is like, well, how do I find purpose? Like, what is the world about? Why are we here? What is why are we taking up space on the planet?
Yeah, that is like the biggest question for many of us, is why are we here? Why am I here? Even more directly.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it depends on what tradition you were raised in. But in a lot of faith traditions, there is often a belief that we were each created for a purpose, a specific purpose, and that God created us with a specific purpose in mind. That, like, when you were conceived, you know, like there was a, you know, God put his thumbprint on it right down your head and said, like, thou shalt be a YouTuber, or like whatever, thou shalt be a teacher, right?
I'm really or whatever. Right now.
Right. And we have this thing that, like, there is a predetermined purpose to our lives, and our job is to figure out what it is and then to do that thing. Right. And I think that is a lot of times what a lot of us believe, is that there is a predetermined purpose and our job is to figure out what it is.
Yeah. It always felt like a hide and go seek game for me. Like I could never, like I had to, like it was out there somewhere and I had to find it, and it pissed me off looking back too. And even back then it pissed me off. Like, why would you hide this from me? Why, if I have this purpose, what's the, just tell me what it is. Let's not play some games here.
Right. Yeah, it's frustrating. And then you're just like, well, what? Okay, so what do I have to do to figure it out? Yeah. And if I can't figure it out, then I'm failing somehow. And I have, like, failed to achieve any meaning in my life. And, you know, I'm like, just become this disappointment to the universe. Right. And I think that in some ways, the idea that there is a predetermined purpose is comforting, because right, it gives order to the universe, right? There's this idea, in the same way that, you know, having a higher intelligence is often comforting, that there's this order to the universe, and it's out there, and our job is just to figure out what the predetermined order is, and that's all we got to do.
And in some sense, it takes the responsibility off of me, if the purpose has already been designated.
Correct.
I don't have to do that extra work or even be responsible for the plan or creating the purpose.
Right, exactly. So my thoughts about this were really influenced by Jean-Paul Sartre. He has this wonderful essay called Existentialism is a Humanism, right? And I talked about how humanism is like that sort of thinking about the source of values and meanings as coming from human beings rather than from God or anywhere else. And he says, okay, let's assume that there is no God. Let's assume that that the idea that God has given you a predetermined purpose is false. And he kind of starts with that assumption. And so the question is, well, what then? How do we do it? And he suggests that, like, what happens is that we all just kind of show up here. We just, we don't come into this world with a predetermined purpose. We just are born. And like, here we are, ta-da, like you're here through the like accident of evolution. We've got you. So now what, right? And he has this phrase that is kind of like that in a nutshell. He says, existence precedes essence. And by that, he means existence, okay. Right? You exist. Precedes is before your essence, your meaning, your purpose, your function, your whatever.
Okay. So kind of like you decide your own purpose kind of thing, because first you exist and then you assign your purpose to yourself. It's not like the universe does it for you. Is that what it means?
Exactly. He's like, you know, we are not, a human being is different than a wrench. It's not that someone said like, I have a function in mind. I need to turn this bolt. I got to create a thing that will fit on there to do this one thing. And the reason I created it is so that it can do this one thing. Human beings aren't like that. We don't come into the world and say like, okay, well, you have this problem and we need you, Eric, we're going to get you here on the planet so you can fix this one thing. He's like, that's just not how it works. We show up and there's this big, messy world and it's confusing and it's chaotic. And here we are. And our responsibility as humans is to look around the world and to make decisions about what we're going to do with our lives and with our situation that we're born into. And so that we become then responsible for making decisions about that. And it's not easy, right? In a way, it's simultaneously freeing because, your purpose can be whatever you want it to be. You get to decide what your purpose is. But of course, the usual response is like, I don't like that. That's really scary, right? Like, what do you mean I have to decide, right?
Yeah.
And so he says that humans, we have this very unique ability to create meaning. It's something that he thinks, and you know, I don't know if this is true or not, I guess people can debate it, but like he thinks other creatures don't have this ability to decide the meaning of our lives. We show up in the world where we aren't responsible for the household we're born into, the body we're born into, our gender, our skin color, our raising, our environment. There are a lot of things that we don't get to decide, right? But as humans, the one thing that we do get to decide is we get to decide what all of that means to us.
Mm-hmm.
We get to tell the story.
And like a lot of, I feel like there is a repetition on like the purposes of different people. So like, I feel like the most common answers could be to either be happy/successful or to, as Eric said before, leave the world a better place than you found it. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is any reason why people orbitate towards these two purposes, or are there any that I'm missing maybe?
Well, honestly, I think the happiness one seems to me to be like a very American thing. That like we want to be happy. It seems like a very culturally specific thing. I think there are lots of people in many other places and many other times who just thought like, it doesn't matter if you're happy or not. Like the goal is to like do your duty and, you know, and your duty is determined by your role, which is determined by what family you're born to and where you show up in society. And, you know, if you're born to the shoemakers, then your purpose is to like make shoes and you like make good shoes and that's what you do and happiness has nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I guess it also changes like in time. So like even in the same country, like I guess maybe in the UK also like a few years ago, if you were a shoe repairer, that's what you did. And yeah, I guess happiness had nothing to do with it. Yeah. Yeah. I think that was a very whitewashed thing what I just said. I apologize. Didn't think about that. Yeah.
No, but I think that's right. I mean, I feel like most people, when you say like, what's the purpose? I'm like, I don't know, to be happy. Right. And that's sort of where a lot of us are right now. And maybe it is I don't know if it's a culturally white thing to say, but I do think that it is a like 20th, 21st century, Western American type thing to say. The other thing about like leaving the world better than you found it, like, okay, that's good. But then you have to ask the next question is like, well, what does that mean?
Yeah. But and in some sense, individually, we can define that.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like, it puts each of us in the driver's seat.
Yeah. What would a better world look like to me? Because it's really kind of subjective. From a better world for me is different than a better world for a Maya or a better world for you, Danielle, too. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of going back to existence before essence. And if it almost sounds like there is no essence, period. It's almost like life is inherently meaningless, or the world and the universe is inherently meaningless if we start and strip away that very basic part. Is that kind of what Sartre was saying?
Yeah, I think so. That you kind of start with the assumption that the world is meaningless, right? That there is no like truth written in the clouds, right? And he says, like, look, when in Europe, in the like Enlightenment era, when the world became more secular, right? And in the like scientific revolution, when it became more secular, what happened is that a lot of thinkers stopped using the word God and they started using the word nature, because nature had this like secular connotation. But then it still had this idea that like there's a natural order, right? And there's like a truth, and there's like morally good things and morally bad things, and they're written in the clouds. And Sartre just says, like, none of that is real. Those are all human inventions. The human beings have come up with all of these ideas about what's true, what's not true, what's good, what's bad. That's part of what makes us kind of amazing as humans, is that we can make these kinds of judgments and we can tell these kinds of stories. But the world itself just is what it is. It's not good or bad. It's not meaningful in any particular way. It has no structure. It has no inherent meaning. We ascribe the meaning to it. And each of us ascribes our meaning to it. And then we collectively ascribe a meaning to it. Mm.
But it seems so easy to just stop at the world is meaningless. The universe is meaningless. And so like the follow-up, almost the natural follow-up to that would be like, well, what's the point? Why do I bother if it's meaningless in a sense? So it almost seems like the starting point is kind of dangerous. And because when I was coming out of religion and I saw that the universe and world was meaningless, it depressed the hell out of me. And for a person who, like myself, without medications can have suicidal thoughts, that's kind of scary.
Yeah, it is. And it's why the existentialists call it the abyss, right? It is like the idea that the world is meaningless. It feels like the ground gets pulled out from under you, right? And Sartre had no illusions about this. I mean, he said, like, he wrote so much about anguish. Like, anguish is the appropriate response in some ways to the fact that the world is meaningless. The fact that we have to be responsible for all of the meaning of our lives and of the world, and we have to choose our values, and we have to decide what's good and bad and right and wrong, and we can't get those answers from outside of ourselves. And we can try, right? He even says, like, you can try. You can, like, go ask your parents or ask a preacher or ask an advisor of some sort, a trusted mentor. But even in choosing who you ask, you're making a decision about what kind of answer you're looking for.
Damn it.
Right? You like can't escape it.
Yeah.
But it's also kind of freeing, right? Because like then it's like you choose. It's, you know, it's like independence. I get how obviously it's very scary and it leads you to what you said of the dark hole, let's say. But also it must be really, I don't know. For me personally, it was just very freeing to realize it. I'm not sure if other people can relate.
Yeah, I think it is both, right? It's this weird paradox because it is both free. Like he says, freedom. We are condemned to be free. That's Sartre's quote. We are condemned to be free. It is both freedom, liberation, the world is open. We get to choose. We get to decide. And we can't escape our freedom. We always are responsible for what we choose.
So it's two sides of the same coin. It can be the abyss, but it can also be freedom.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And, you know, like, you can go to your most trusted advisor, your most trusted mentor. You can get advice from them. You can claim, like, well, I have to follow this person's advice because they told me the right thing. One, you can always choose your advisor. And two, you can always choose whether or not to listen to them.
So how can we get past that depressing abyss? Like, what would be like the next step to just the next step? Like, how do we get past that?
Right. So this idea that like the world is inherently meaningless, as you said, I think a lot of times what people do is they have a lot of work to come to that place, right? Like giving up religion, giving up these faith traditions, saying no to them is a lot of work. It's a lot of intellectual work. It's a lot of emotional work. And it feels like we do it and then we're left with nothing. Like we're left with this, like, you know,
we're back to existence.
Exactly. It's the big dark hole and there's nothing to do about it. And it's interesting because Friedrich Nietzsche, also an existentialist, he has a wonderful allegory called, it's at the beginning of his book, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, tongue twister there. And it's the very first allegory, and he calls it the three metamorphoses of the spirit. He says, here goes the three metamorphoses of the spirit. First, the spirit becomes a camel. And the camel is the pack animal. And the camel puts on all of the expectations and social rules and, you know, all of the things that we're supposed to do and supposed to be, and the things that we grow up with, all of these things that we kind of carry around with us.
And then when you say spirit, is he referring to like our consciousness, our self, not necessarily like
not a soul.
Soul, okay, all right.
Yeah, I mean, the word spirit is a translation. I would guess that I don't know actually what the original German is. I would guess it's daemon, but I don't know. And I think it's appropriate to think about it not necessarily as like a metaphysical soul, but just as a human consciousness, right? Like the evolution of a human. And when we say like a spiritual awakening, right? Like that kind of spirit.
Okay. So the pack animal is sort of the first step. You pile stuff on to yourself.
Right. And that's like, and
that includes like meanings and world ways of seeing the world.
Yes. And that can be, you know, the stuff your schools taught you, your parents taught you, your church taught you, your government taught you, your communities taught you, all the stuff gets piled on. And then he says the camel speeds off into the loneliest of deserts, right? And there the camel transforms into...
So fucking depressing.
I promise it'll get better. I'll get
okay,
better.
Okay, all right. Okay.
You gotta go through the valley to come out.
Yes, I'm getting it. Yeah, that's...
So then the camel speeds off into the loneliest of deserts. And there the camel transforms into the lion. And he says the lion is needed to be the great denier, the no. He says the lion fights the dragon of the great thou shalt that has thousands of years of values glittering on its scales. And the dragon or the lion is the denier. No, 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 no. It's a fight. And a lot of us have been through that fight. You do all that work of saying like, this is not mine. This is not mine. This is not mine. I don't believe in that.
So the camel transforms in lion and the lion looks at all the stuff that's been piled on the camel, like the pile of stuff laying in there in the desert, and sorts through it and says, no, 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 no. Is that right?
That's right. It is the denier. It is the dismantler. Right? The lion is the great dismantler.
Okay.
And I think what happens is a lot of people go through that process. They speed off into the lonely desert, they turn into the lion, they dismantle everything, and then they stop. And then when you stop there, a couple things can happen. One, you can get real depressed, as you have, discussed, right? It can be just a really dark place. You can also get really cynical and say, what's the point? Nothing matters. What's the point? I shouldn't even try. I'm going to go find some drugs and, snack on Cheetos and watch TV for the rest of my life because whatever, it doesn't matter. Right. You give up the idea of meaning altogether. And I think a lot of people get stuck there, but Nietzsche says the spirit's journey is not complete at the lion. The final stage is the transformation from the lion to the child. And he says the child is needed for the sacred work of saying yes to something. The child is needed to create something. It is the first turning of the wheel. It is the first step towards something new. It is putting one block on top of another block and choosing something and saying yes to something. This, I am going to choose this as meaningful. I'm going to tell this story and I'm going to own this story and I'm going to say yes, knowing that it's my choice, knowing that these truths do not come from the skies or the heavens or the great lords. It comes from nowhere except myself. And that's good enough. It's good enough to say, I'm going to choose this and I'm going to say yes to the world because I'm a human being and human beings move through the world. And the thing that we can do that no other creatures do is we say that we live lives of meaning and we get to decide what that meaning is.
So I guess the question is, how can we move from the lion spirit to a child spirit in our lives, in a practical way? How can we achieve that transformation?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think there might be different ways that people would think about this. And I, as in my work as a coach, I have people come into my office who are there. They are in the lion stage and they come in and they're just like, I don't even see why anyone exists. Right. And sometimes, it can be scary, right? Because as you suggested, Eric, people can very easily tip over into suicidal ideation, right? But I think that when you're at that place, the first question I guess I ask people is whether or not they believe it's possible to choose meaning, right? Like you have to introduce the idea that the movement from the lion to the child is an act of will.
So do you have to believe in free will to do this change?
I think whether or not you do is not that important. You have to believe in free will enough to suppose that you can exercise something that looks like free will.
Okay.
Right? When I say an act of will, I think it's a decision that we make.
So really the step out of it is to ask yourself, can we create meaning? That's cool. And that's something that doesn't necessarily come naturally to folks who are in that lion stage.
Right. Because we're still looking for meaning out there. Right. And we say that's wrong. That's wrong. I don't believe in that. I don't believe in that. Those people lied to me. Why? Everything's terrible. And the end. And I think that a lot of times people are still waiting for the sky to open up for the truth.
I could see that. Yeah. So yeah, I was like, what I was told doesn't work. Like there's no meaning over there, but there has to be out there somewhere. And maybe it'll come to me somehow.
Right. If I just read the right books or follow the right guru or take the right meditation course or, whatever, go to the right retreat or whatever it means. I'm looking for my new church. I'm not going to call it that, but that's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So how do we, once we ask that question, can meaning be created? Can we define it for ourselves? how do we do that? How do we choose it? It doesn't sound like it's something that can be found, and so we have to learn it.
Yes, it's a skill. I think that's really important, right? So it is a practice. We need to see our lives as something, we are writing our own stories, right? I think that like the way I tend to talk about it is like, we are the authors of our own stories. And again, we don't always choose what happens to us, but we do choose the meaning of what happens to us.
Okay.
Right? And we get to decide what to do with what happens to us. So I suppose now is a good time to talk about my broken brain. when I was 3 months after my daughter was born, she's 4 and a half now, 3 months after my daughter was born, I was in a new city, didn't really have friends and family around. I was 5 months pregnant when my husband and I moved, and didn't have a lot of support, didn't know a lot of people in town, new parent. And I had gotten into this very intense experience of anxiety, hormones, some crazy concoction of something. I'm still not quite sure what happened, but I went through this cycle of I couldn't sleep, was having terrible insomnia, the anxiety about not being able to sleep, right? I try and fall asleep because the baby's got to be up and I got to nurse her in a couple hours. So I quick got to fall asleep, but I can't sleep. And then I get anxious about not sleeping and then be up. And then, you know, just this cycle of insomnia and anxiety happened to the point where like, most nights I was getting maybe 3-4 hours of sleep for like weeks. And my brain sort of went into philosophy overdrive, and it got to the point where I could not reasonably for myself distinguish what was real from what wasn't real. And I spent 5 days in a psych hospital with psychosis. And then another like month and a half in an outpatient program. And another year after that in therapy, trying to put the pieces of my life back together. Now I had my PhD before this happened, right? So I'm someone who is an academic. I like built a career, built an identity as someone who thinks well and who at the very least can like distinguish real from not real, right? And my identity as a thinker was really, really important to me. And suddenly that was totally undermined. Suddenly I was like a crazy person, and I hadn't had any really like mental health stuff in the past. It was new. It was terrifying. It totally shattered my entire sense of self. I felt like I'd blown up my life. I'd moved from my great job in New York to like come to Portland because I didn't want to live in New York City anymore. I had this kid, everything fell to pieces. And then I was like, I got to get a job, because I cannot be in my house with this small baby by myself anymore. So I found a job. I like was teaching history to a local high school, private high school, to ninth graders, which was just awful. It was not a good fit for me. And I remember I just spent much of that year just being like, everything is ruined. Like my entire, you know, like this, it's a tragic thing that happened. At best, it's a tragedy that has befallen me. At worst, it's all my fault, and I like am a failure as a human. And at best, it is a terrible tragedy that's not my fault, but just happened to befall me. And it's meaningless, and my life is terrible now. And I remember going, like sitting on the couch with myself one night and just saying, this can't be the end of my story. If this is the end of my story, then my story sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't like, this cannot be the meaning of my life. Like I have a baby, I go crazy at the end. And so I said to myself, like, I need to do something to integrate this experience into my life in a positive way so that I can feel like I can move forward. And that's when I decided that I would, was going to send out a piece for publication that I had written about the experience. And I organized a talk, a public reading, where I like gathered 40, 50 people in a room and like told them about my experience. And that sent me on this like healing journey where then now my work is to talk with women who are struggling with the transition to motherhood and to do this philosophical counseling thing, which was the only thing I could think to do that didn't make me want to cry every day. And So now I have this life that I get to like do this thing that I've really kind of always wanted to do. I never thought I would deal with motherhood, but the idea of like doing philosophy for the people in a public space was just something I always wanted to do. And because of that experience, now I look back and now I get to decide what that experience means to me. I can say, oh, that was a time when like that is like, you know, a blip in my life that I don't ever have to think about again. I can put it in a box. That was the crazy time and I'm not that person, right? I can say that that was a tragedy that like I'll never recover from and will haunt me forever. Or I can say, as I do, that experience was an incredible gift because it made me fearless and courageous in a way that I never was before. And I am incredibly grateful for it because it opened the channel of my life. Like the bottom dropped out, but because of it, the top went up and I am living bigger and better because
of it. Okay.
I can tell this story.
Wow, I really admire you for that because I struggle with anxiety and depression, but so I know how hard it is to make that change. And I think, okay, I'm going to focus this on a positive side. And I just can't imagine how challenging I must have been like with a baby.
Oh yeah.
And anyways, with no support, no help really. I really admire what you did. I think it's such a wonderful thing. And the fact that now you're helping people with the same problems, it's so amazing. It's so, so wonderful.
Thanks. And I think that I do it because it makes that experience feel meaningful, right? So I've shifted my sense of purpose to say, okay, I always knew that I love philosophy. I always knew that I love teaching. I always knew I love speaking to people and connecting with people and writing. And I wanted to sort of be out there and doing it. And suddenly this experience gave that a focus. And I for a long time, I really resisted it. I was just like, no, I'm going to do like public philosophy. And like, I don't want to do the motherhood stuff. In part because like motherhood is seen as like weak and feminine. And it was all my like internalized sexism, right? That was just like, I was like, I don't care about like fun activities to do with your kids or like crafts or I don't know, recipes for like homemade organic cheese crackers or whatever like people blog about when they talk about motherhood. I just like wasn't interested. And so I was like, I don't want to be in that realm. I don't want to be doing that. It's not me. I'm like tough. I'm like, you know, I'm like a thinker. I don't want to be taken seriously. And finally, I was in a business class and the teacher, I was talking with the teacher and she was just like, why aren't you doing this? This is the work that you should be doing. You should be talking to moms and they need you specifically because there are other mothers out there who don't care about crafts and they'd like want to hear from you. So like, go talk to them. And I was like, yeah, okay. And so now once I started, then I was like, okay, well maybe I'll try teaching this class on motherhood. This like workshop thing that I sort of dreamt up. And I tried it and turns out that I loved it. And I felt suddenly it was like, oh, suddenly I'm seeing all these experiences come together and be integrated. And it feels like I've found my purpose, right? It feels like this is the thing I was always meant to do. This is why, oh, that's why that happened. It happened so I could be here, right? But I know because I'm a secular humanist, because I studied CERT, that like that is a story that I'm choosing to tell myself.
Okay. So, all right. I like that piece. What you said was, I went through this tragedy and after I come through it, I'm deciding to reframe it as a positive thing that sort of motivated me to do something I love. I hear that, but it also seems like I can hear that sort of being used almost as, I went through this horrible relationship. I was, physically, mentally abused. But I came out of it stronger. I don't know. It sounds, or I had this religious experience and so now I'm going to do missionary work. It really sounds like it could be used almost like a double-edged sword in some sense to both motivate you to do something that you, to create and find meaning, but also to almost keep you into the same place you were before, or the same mindset you were before?
I don't know. I mean, can you spell that out, right? Like the idea that I mean, yes, we can always rationalize our choices.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, like, but I like the part that you said about, I understand that there is no meaning out there, and so I'm creating this for myself. That realization almost seems to be kind of like the key.
Yes.
To still continuing to have that freedom of creating the meaning and purpose for your, or creating the purpose for your life and meaning in your life.
Yeah, and I think that I know, I mean, the other part of this, if you're going to kind of go with this like Sartrean view of things, the other part of it is that he says, like, look, you gotta know that you're the one pulling the strings here.
Yeah.
You.
And that's where the power is. That's where the freedom is. And you can also, it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, it also sounds like you can change your mind. You have that freedom to change your mind, change the purpose of your life.
Right. It may be that I wake up tomorrow and I suddenly decide for whatever reason, that was the old me. That's not me anymore. However many years were just me running out some steam. What I really want to do is underwater basket weaving. I finally found my thing, right? Like, who knows? Maybe I'll have an epitome and I'll rewrite my story again. I'm sure that something else will happen in my life in which the story evolves, right? And the story can shift and change over time. But the thing is that I think what happens is that we are so attached to the idea that there is a one true right answer for ourselves. And we're so attached to that old paradigm of there is a truth, that when we come up with our own story, we get attached to it in a way that starts to, we fall into the spirit of seriousness, right? We take it so seriously. This has to be my meaning. This has to be who I am now, because if I can't, then everything is lost, right? And you forget that actually you were the one that created it in the first place, right? You write the rules. He said, Sartre says, it's like if you were playing a soccer game and suddenly you mistook, you take the game seriously. We all collectively agree that these are the rules, and you decide that this is how it's supposed to be, and we create the borders, and we create the structures, and we create the meaning and the values. When this person kicks the ball into that net, then that means that they get a goal. But that action actually has no inherent meaning whatsoever. We've just collectively agreed that that's what it is, right? And when we get to the point where we think that, that must be what that means, we fall into the spirit of seriousness. We become so, we start to reify our stories. We turn our stories into gods.
I love that. We fall into the spirit of seriousness. Yeah. Yeah. So, so this is a skill. It doesn't sound like it's something that comes naturally to humans at all. And it's something that we have to continue to work on and continue to re-examine. And there is always a higher level or a different level of this skill that we can discover. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think that it takes practice to be able to see your life in this way, right? It takes, again, referring to Sartre, he says, we must have a spirit of play. We need to think about our lives in a more playful way, right? Because ultimately, we don't know. We're just making it up as we go along. It's one big experiment. We're just trying. And we also can work our entire lives for some end and not get there, or get there and then have someone else dismantle it. We don't know what's going to happen in the end, right? And ultimately, we're all going to grow old. We're all going to die. Our great grandkids probably won't know our names, and the sun will explode in the end, right? In the end, nothing actually matters, but who cares? We're here. This is our human lives. And we get to play in this world while we're here. We get to build sandcastles, big and beautiful, knowing that they're going to be washed away. So make it the best, biggest, beautiful, most beautiful, wonderful sandcastle you can. And that act of doing it is meaningful because you have one life to live, and here it is, and do it.
And just because you change your meaning throughout your life, that doesn't mean that the meaning you assigned yourself before was incorrect necessarily, right? So it could be that in different phases of your life, you have different meanings because you grow as a person and you change and you develop and...
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, never did I think like I would be talking to mothers about motherhood. That was like the least interesting thing in the world to me. And then suddenly, like, here I am. And I had to kind of get used to the idea. I resisted, like I said, I resisted it for a good year. I was just like, right? And I'm doing it because when I do it, I feel alive. I feel like it gives my experiences meaning. And so I continue to choose it.
It almost sounds like this type of this skill, the practicing this skill, can also be applied to past regrets, and almost like reframing past sorrows, and help to possibly, does it help to possibly deal with past trauma too?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a whole, you know, I'm not a therapist, so I'm sure there are people here who could speak to it better than I could, but there is a methodology of therapy called narrative therapy. And the whole idea is exactly as I've talked about, reframing our experiences into a positive self-affirming, life-affirming narrative, right? And I think...
Well, when you say life-affirming, well, what does that, what do you mean by that? Like, this is... been pushing me towards who I am now, or
I think
contributed it, to?
Yeah. I think it means something different for everyone.
Okay.
I think life-affirming is generally, in my mind, connected to a narrative of, like, growth and increased capacity for learning, compassion, connection, meaning, etc.
So narrative therapy helps to kind of get to that end of reframing it as life affirming and stuff like that.
Right. And looking back at your past experiences and saying, what is the story I am telling myself about these experiences? What is the story? Again, my experience, I could frame that as, you know, and sometimes in my darkest moments I do, like, that madness was in me all along and came from a long lineages of, like, sick women in my family, and it is who I am at my core, and that's who I will be forevermore, and everything else that I do is just simply trying to cover that up. I could tell myself that story.
Yeah.
But if I live that life, I'm probably not going to be super helpful to people. Like, I won't be able, probably won't feel super good about myself. I probably won't parent my kid very well. I probably won't be very effective in my career. You know, I will be unhappy. And so I'm choosing, because again, life doesn't come in a form. It's not like that's more true than the other story I choose to tell, which is like, that was a nightmare of an experience. But
oh my gosh. So there, oh, that's so, okay. So there isn't really, like you're saying, like the way I looked at it back then is just as true as the way I look at it now.
Yes.
So the both of them are, they're inherently meaningless, but I can change how I see it. And god damn it, that's even more freedom, but also more responsibility too.
Yes. Wow. Yes. And the thing is that it's your whole life, right? Sartre says you can change your mind about your story until you are dead. Like, until your last breath, you can change your mind.
I'm kind of feeling giddy inside, like, and it kind of, I'm feeling a hope.
Oh, good. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, like, you have to go through the valley, right? To come out the other side. You have to, because telling people like, oh, No, your life has meaning. You just don't know what it is yet. You're failing to figure out what it is. It's like not, it's not ultimately helpful, right? You have to say like, look, okay, the world's meaningless. Yeah, it is. I'm not going to try and convince you otherwise. And yet if you accept that and if you stop fighting it and really say like, I'm going to own my responsibility as a human being on this planet to create the meaning of my own life, then I'm like living. Mm. I'm really living.
And how can someone, so you mentioned feelings of regret. In the cases in which someone feels regret because they have hurt someone else. So for example, I know a lot of religious people feel guilty because they have converted other people in the past and they feel guilty about the potential harm they have done to them. How can they change their viewpoints, as you said, in a more positive way of how can they rewrite the narrative of their previous story to think, okay, what? How can I see this in a more positive light?
Yeah, I think there are lots of ways to do it, right? Like, and I think it's important for when people do it, you have to tell a story that feels authentic to you, right? Because if you're going to tell a story that's just like, oh, well, I'm going to try and like put a like, rosy lens on it and like convince myself that it wasn't that bad or that like maybe those people were helped in some way or whatever, like it's not going to feel authentic. I think sometimes that feeling of authentic means grieving your past behaviors or your past ignorance or your past experiences and knowing that you can't undo them. And I think a lot of it is also connecting to compassion for yourself and to your own humanity and to saying, because a lot of times we look at ourselves and we're like, me now, I am really smart. Me in the past, that person was an idiot. I don't know what that person was thinking. Why are you such an idiot? Right? And then we're like, God, why am I such an idiot? And then we beat up on ourselves and we go through this like self-flagellating process where all that we can do is just like beat up on our past selves. And I think that one important piece of it is looking at our past selves and connecting with the humanity of that person. And saying, man, you are a person that was just doing the best you could with the information that you had at the time, right? And the resources that you had and the things that you were able to see and the story you were telling yourself, this is the choice that you made. And me here in the future wouldn't make that same choice. But you know what? In the same way that we would be offering compassion to a friend or to a child that had done something that they regret, we can offer that to our past selves and say like, look, buddy, you were just doing the best you could, you know? And when we start there, then I think the new story kind of becomes clear to us what that story, that authentic story looks like for us.
Wow. Well, holy moly. I mean, you literally took us through that whole process. Like there was a moment where I'm just sitting here totally depressed, just like looking around like this is meaningless. But then you brought us out of that valley and into some hope. I didn't go into this damn thing expecting you to do that to us, but man, I feel so much better on the end. This was amazing. This was so cool. Do you have anything else you want to share with us about this?
No, I'll stop talking. I'm happy to take some questions.
You don't need to stop talking. I mean, I'm loving this so much.
You're so hopeful. It was so, so nice. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I really believe it. I just feel like, and I think one of the things that is really so painful about our world is that there are so many people in the world that not only are denied resources and access and opportunities, but denied stories of hope and the belief that they are able to rewrite their own stories. Because don't get me wrong, some people have more resources and access and opportunities than other people, right? And I don't want to, I think one of the objections to existentialism is that it's a bourgeois philosophy, right?
Right.
That it's for rich, middle upper class people with access. And And I think that we need to understand when we are talking with people that there are forces in the world that push on us. There are messages that are sort of like programmed that we have to work. That's that camel, like throwing everything off. We have to do the work of dismantling those things. And that takes work and it takes help and it takes, you know, education and accesses and resources. And we need to help people with those things as much as we can. And but I do think that ability to choose hope and to create meaning is available to all of us. And when people feel like it isn't available to them, I think that is where real damage is done. And when we are talking with people, we need to take seriously the impact of all of those external forces of oppression. And we need to find the space between ourselves and those forces in which we can do that interpretive work of creating the meaning of those forces in our lives.
Awesome. Danielle, thank you so much. There's a lot of pollen in the air, so I'm getting some allergies, but yeah, you've left me with a lot of hope kind of going forward, and I really, really appreciate that. Folks, before we go to the Q&A, we've got several great questions. I've got some resources here that Danielle has assembled. We'll go ahead and post in the chat, but in a few days, this whole discussion will be up on YouTube, and all of the resources as well as links for Danielle will all be there as well. Amaya, why don't you take us off into the Q&A session?
Sure. So we have three questions from the same person via email, who sent us an email a couple of weeks ago. Do you want me to read all of them at once, or maybe one by one, because they're quite long? Okay. But they come from the same person. So what do you prefer, one by one or all at the same time?
Well, are there other questions from other people that we would want to speak to?
Yes, there are.
Why don't we do all of them just so we can, or maybe choose one of the three, just because I want to make sure that we have time for other people to ask questions too.
Yeah. Okay. Then I'm going to choose the last one, because I feel like it's the more interesting one. So as with the other two questions, which I'm not going to read, I guess the third point also comes from a sense of philosophical loneliness. I have never been religious. However, the belief and assumption of free will in my society, even by atheists, is a constant reminder of how religious dogma is so influential, because this person apparently doesn't believe in free will. I am not sure what my question is, but I find myself in philosophical and political discomfort knowing that people believe in philosophies I find nonsensical, especially the belief in free will, which I find to be one of the key influencers of injustice. So I guess the question behind this is, how can we deal with that philosophical loneliness when the people around us don't share the same viewpoints as us, or the same philosophical positionings as us?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the great advantages of philosophy is that it provides a model for discourse. For being able to have conversations with people with whom you fundamentally disagree, and to nevertheless treat their arguments seriously and respectfully, and to ask honest and earnest questions. And also to have a bit of humility around the whole thing. Right, especially for people who grew up believing one set of things, and then we throw those things off. And I think what can happen is that people can get really dogmatic about, because there was so much pain associated with that way of thinking, right? Like that way of believing was just like so felt really stifling or felt really damaging in whatever way. And then we can think like, these people, anyone who believes this is brainwashed and they're an idiot and they're doing damage to the world and like we shouldn't trust them, right? We get really dogmatic about it. And I think that part of the kind of intellectual maturity comes from seeing that, you know, they believe something different than we do. And maybe it's because they just haven't done that work of like examining, dismantling, being critical of what they've been told. It's possible that they just haven't had the education or the resources or the interest and are like willfully ignoring it, whatever. Like there's some process there. Or maybe they've done the work and they've just come to a different conclusion than you have come to. I think either way, to say that, like, once your emotions of like, you're an idiot and I shouldn't listen to you get involved, then we need to ask ourselves what's going on with us, right? And certainly there are certain, like, don't get me wrong, I think that there are certain beliefs that can be really, really damaging, right? Like hateful ideologies and violent ideologies and so on and so forth, like a lot of which that we're seeing in our current political climate can be really damaging. And yet, I don't know, maybe this is part of my, I think this actually comes from my Buddhist side. I tend to believe that human beings are fundamentally good. And, you know, I heard a quote recently that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are good people and there are good people in pain. And I think that I just fundamentally believe that human beings we're just trying to be known and loved and understood and seen. And if you can be with someone and recognize that in them, that they're just trying to be known and loved and understood and seen, and you can be present with their pain and be present with your own pain, then you're able to actually engage in a conversation where you just may intellectually disagree, but that doesn't like fundamentally interrupt the safety of your being. That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does make sense. Thank you.
Got another question here. I'll just read it as it is. So I've heard about the purpose-driven life. And of course, there are people encouraging others to talk to their God to find out what he has in store for them. Do I continue to be antisocial and keep it moving? Or do I inform them that all gods are imaginary and do what you desire as long as it doesn't cause any harm to people or it's not illegal? So I think that what he's asking is how, for people who have a religious based purpose or meaning behind them, do I disrupt that with a conversation, or should I just let them be since it's their own purpose?
Yeah, I think it depends on the context, right? Like sometimes people don't want your opinion. Like they're just not interested in hearing that you think that like they're stupid for believing in God. And I don't think that, I think it's maybe like helpful to not offer your opinion when it's on that. Unless you see that it serves an important purpose in the fact that person seems open to having the conversation, right? So for example, I had a couple of Mormons come to my house who were proselytizing, and oh man, it was so great. I invited them into my kitchen, these two young women. They were like in their early 20s, and they were there for the purpose of talking about faith. So I'm like, okay, great, let's talk about this. And whenever I talk to someone who is religious about faith, I try and stay as absolutely curious as I can about why they believe what they believe, how they think, because in my mind, a lot of there has to be a lot of cognitive dissonance happening in order for a lot of those belief structures to like remain in place. But like we all have cognitive dissonance about something, right? Like we all move through the world like kind of believing conflicting things, and we're kind of fine with that, right? Different people attach to different things. So I always get like, I bristle at people who turn their atheism into a new kind of religion and they start proselytizing their atheism, because I think that like sometimes people need God. It serves a good purpose for them. They find comfort, they find meaning, they find, you know, community in their faith. And if it's working for them, insofar as it's not damaging people, right? And I know that there are a lot of faith traditions that like exclude gay people and have, you know, like fought wars over their faith, right? That's a different issue in my mind, right? If they have a faith that is not propelling hate speech, then like more power to you. If it works for you, it works for you. Fine. For me, I don't feel like I need it. I can like live a life. I have this, you know, secular humanist structure that works for me. And I find it really more fulfilling than I found that. Fine.
Yeah, I mean, if your religion is keeping you from doing horrible things,
right.
Stay religious.
Yeah. Like go for it. I mean, you mentioned in my bio, I have a podcast. We've stopped putting out new episodes, but we have a pretty good archive. And my co-host, Jose Muniz, is a theist. He's a philosopher, and he believes in God, and he's a Christian. He grew up Catholic, and several of our episodes are actually about, like, theists and an atheist have a conversation about whether or not God exists. And he is a dear friend of mine, and I love him, and I love having those conversations with him, and I don't think less of him because he happens to believe that way. It's just he has a different set of life experiences. He's written a different story than I've written.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah. Another question that we have is, I can't stop comparing my boring life to the lives of great, positive, optimistic, accomplished other people. How do I get over these feelings?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think in that question, there are values there. There is a story, right? That like fantastic accomplished people are one kind of person and I'm another kind of person and I can't jump over there. We're like, the, you know, difference in kind here. And that's a really powerful narrative. And the narrative could be like, oh, I'm boring. Nothing good happens to me. You know, whatever your life is. That someone else who has had a totally different life will find your life fascinating, right? Like you're always like interesting to somebody, even if you don't feel interesting to yourself. Someone, you know, like you grow up as I did in like, you know, down home, like white suburbia in like an evangelical faith. I went to like a mega church when I was a kid, like Jumbotrons and like, live feed to the nosebleed seats. Like it was a big thing. Right. And to someone like, and to me, I'm like, that just feels like the most like pedestrian like thing ever. And I've told this story to other people and they're like, oh my God, tell me everything. I want to know it all.
That's usually me. When I joined RFR, I was like, wait, what? You've been in this cult all your life? What do you mean? Tell me about it. How was the experience? Like, yeah.
Right. So like your life is always interesting to someone.
Yeah.
So I think like, again, it's always a story that you tell yourself about what your life means. And it could be that like my life is that, you know, like for example, I'm still working with this, right? I grew up to middle class, like working parents. My mom like stocked grocery shelves and my dad like sold paper. And it was like an office supply salesman, right? And then I moved to New York and I met all these people who were like, had parents who were like journalists at the New York Times and like, we're doing, you know, bankers on Wall Street and we're doing all these like fantastic things. And I was just like, my life is boring. Whoa. And I told myself this story that like, I don't have access to that kind of success because it's not who I am, it's not where I come from. And I literally in my kitchen the other day, I was just like, how long am I going to tell myself this story? Because it's kind of getting old.
Yeah.
And so you can always choose. You can always choose that, like, you know, I used to believe that I couldn't do those things. And then one day I just decided I didn't want to live that way anymore. And I started believing that it was possible for me. And then my life changed.
Yeah.
That can be your story.
Yeah. My wife thinks that her story is really boring and I'm like, tell me more. It's freaking amazing. Can I help you write a book, please? People would love to hear from you and what you have to say and what you've taken from your experiences. Yeah. Yeah. But on the flip side of that, there we kind of touched on a little bit. There are some people who agonize over their life, and then there's also some people who don't agonize over their life. What's the difference? I think we kind of talked about it, but what's the difference there? It almost sounds like it's just the story they tell themselves.
I think it's a habit.
Oh my gosh, yes.
I think it's a mental habit, right? Like, if you, and I also think it's sort of an addiction to a sense of identity, right?
And that addiction can feel comforting. It's what I know. It's where I've been. It's not unknown. I can totally relate to that. Damn it, Danielle.
The only reason I can speak to any of this is because I live it, right? Because I am constantly having to discover these new things about myself because I, it's a struggle for me too. I can talk about this in a way that feels very wise, but it's, you should see me. You should have seen me yesterday. I think that we get addicted to this story that oh, that's who I am. That's my issue. I'll never do that because that's my issue. And I'm I've got to continue to work through this issue and I'm going to keep working through this issue. And then maybe someday, once I'm done working through this issue, I can achieve that thing. But you become so attached to this old sense of self, this old identity. And one thing I always say to my clients is, I don't know if you remember that old George Carlin bit where, comedian, and he talks about how your shit is stuff, but other people's stuff is shit, right? He has this whole comedy sketch where he's move your shit. I got to put my stuff here, right? This idea that we have about what's ours and what's theirs, right?
Yeah.
And he says, look, I know that my stuff is also shit. It is a giant pile of shit, but it's my pile of shit, right? And I think that that's sort of what happens when we think about all of this shit in our past, these stories that are not serving us, this sense of self that is not serving us, and we know it's not serving us, and we know that it's not helpful, and we know it's keeping us stuck and keeping us depressed and keeping us from achieving what we want to achieve, but it's my pile of shit, and I'm going to roll around in it, and I'm going to keep it, right? And so you need, part of it is being willing to let that go and to step away from hanging on to that sense of identity and being willing to step into the unknown, into an unknown sense of identity. When you act differently and you tell a different story about your life, you don't quite know what that's going to feel like or who you're going to become. And it's scary.
Yeah.
And it's also incredibly, the most exciting thing that we get to do as humans. It is what we get to do.
Yeah. Perfect. I think we have two more questions. So this is kind of, I think, an opinion question. Neil deGrasse Tyson called philosophy as useless. He said this about 6 years ago. He said, my concern here is that philosophers believe they are actually asking deep questions about nature. But the scientist is like, what are you doing? What are you doing concerning yourself with the meaning of meaning? I think that the question to you more is what is the use, what's the point of philosophy? And I liked how you framed it at the beginning that you're a practical philosopher, but how would you kind of respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, philosophers have done a really bad job of speaking on behalf of philosophy. And I think the thing that philosophy does is, one, it's a foundation for all the other disciplines. So, if we want to talk about science, for example, science says, okay, there's a scientific method. If we're going to create a thing or test a theory, this is how we do it. We come up with a hypothesis and then we do this experiment and we test the hypothesis and we see if it's measurable and repeatable and all the things that make a hypothesis a theory, right? And science is going through that process. But I think what the philosopher does is says, is that process a good way of determining whether or not something is true?
Hmm.
Is that process, you know, the best way to figure out knowledge? And as we go through that process, like, for example, there have been a lot of feminist philosophers who look at science and they say, well, you know what? The way that people do the scientific method actually has a lot of gendered assumptions in it. So, for example, if, let's say, a person is trying to do a study on the impact of sexual assault on women's brains, right? And part of the scientific experiment is like someone has subjects and they ask them questions about their experience and, you know, maybe the story they told themselves about this experience. And then another person looks at their brain and then, you know, looks at all the scans and decides what all of that means, right? So the deciding what all of it means is a work of interpretation, which is a philosophical kind of action. And the feminist philosopher will look at that and say, okay, well, if you're interviewing subjects who have been sexually assaulted in order to try and get certain data for your research, it matters whether or not the person who's doing the interviewing, if that person is like a 6'2", 300-pound dude who's interviewing women about their sexual assault experiences, that's going to get you different data than if it is, you know, 120-pound woman.
Got it.
Because there are certain assumptions made there about the scientific process and what is relevant to sort of hold constant and what to kind of what the variables are.
Yeah.
Right. And if you're not aware of what the variables are, because you're in this view that like, this is how we do it. And we just have this sort of like view from nowhere and we're all objective, like independent observers, then you're missing something important. And so I think philosophers do the work of saying, what are the assumptions that you're making here? What is the impact of those assumptions? And how does all that add up to a story that you're telling?
Mm-hmm. So it's like an example. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah. It's like helping science in that regard. Okay.
I think so. I think so.
Yeah. we have a last question, which is, I think, a great one to close the session of Q&A with, which is, how do you know when you found meaning?
I feel a little disheartened by this question, in part because I don't think meaning is found, you know, like that's the whole point, is that you don't find it, you make it.
Well, then how do you know when you've created your meaning?
You can always change it.
Yeah. Does creating a meaning come with like a sense of fulfillment or not necessarily?
I mean, here's what I'll say. I mean, when I came to the point, you know, after I taught that first course on motherhood and suddenly I was able to see that like, oh, all of my philosophical interests and my personal experience kind of like overlap in the Venn diagram here on philosophy of motherhood. And it felt like this eureka moment. And it felt like I've discovered the thing, right? I've discovered my purpose. And I think there is a kind of charge that we feel when we do that. You know, that kind of moment of insight that feels like there is something authentic and true here that I have, and it feels like finding, but that my experiences have brought me to. And not everybody feels that. And sometimes we feel that about things we don't want to feel that about. And sometimes we want to feel that about things and then we don't. And it's very frustrating when we think we're supposed to feel that specific thing and that specific feeling is the you know, like the bell that goes off. It's like, bing, bing, you found it, right? Like, you don't always get that. Yeah. And I'm not sure that it came to me in like a moment. It was like, oh, this is kind of cool. And, oh, yeah, I actually think I really like this. And, like, yeah, I have to deal with these things. But I don't know. I feel like this kind of combines a lot of my interests now that I think about it, right? And that was work, right? The way I talk about it is just like, a light came on. But there was a time of like, this all sort of makes sense to me. And it is a way of integrating all of my experiences together that feels like I don't have to be at war with myself. And that felt good, right? But it doesn't come that way.
So maybe even more basic, you could say you have created your purpose when you say you have. Okay.
Yeah, I think you do. And if you like, I mean, you, the thing is, you always have created your purpose. It just may not be the one that you want, right? Like, you can just be like, yeah, I went to college. I tried to get a job in my field. The economy tanked. And now I don't, you know, like I don't do anything. Or like I had the dream job and then like a pandemic hit and then I got laid off and now it was for nothing. Right? Like we can always tell our stories. We're always creating our purpose. Every moment of the day you are creating your purpose. It just may not be one that feels very fulfilling.
Okay.
Right.
So you can even, you know, the purpose doesn't have to be like some super pie in the sky thing. The meaning, it can be as like, I want to feed hungry people. And so waitressing or being a server is fulfilling to me.
Yeah. Right. I mean, and, you know, like, I think connecting to the larger, like almost always we will feel a sense of meaning when we are able to get in touch with the human component, right? Like if you're a janitor in a hospital, right, you might feel like, I'm like, you know, scrubbing floors and like cleaning toilets and that doesn't feel meaningful. But if you ask, well, why am I doing it? Well, I'm doing it so the room is clean. Okay, well, why do you need a clean room? Well, so that the patients can come in and feel like safe and healthy and secure. And if you're able to see your sweeping and mopping as helping people to feel safe and healthy and cared for, then it feels more meaningful because you can connect to the human component of it. And I think connecting yourself to that something that's larger than me, something that serves other people, even if it's not exactly the thing I would choose, you can choose to tell the story that, you know what, cleaning this toilet is damn important because the next like little kid that has a, you know, comes into the ICU because they got burned and, you know, or whatever is like, it has cancer. Like I want that kid to feel as good as that kid can possibly feel. And so I'm going to clean this toilet.
It's awesome. That's awesome. Danielle, thank you so, so much for this. Man, this was a good one. All right.
Thank you for having me. It was a joy. I mean, I love doing this. And I'm really, yeah, thank you very much.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.